สาวะโตอรหัตโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอรหัตโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอรหัตโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะปะริตังเทศานะมัทสะตุหะเยสุตะวันโตปะมะชะตุสะระSo for this week, while our Chimpan's away, and possibly next week as well, I'm not sure, but anyway, I'd like to do some readings from the Theragatha, and as I mentioned to the monks the other day, I've just finished translation of the Theragatha, and there's a bit of an introduction with it. The files are available on the computer there, and we've got a printout here if anybody wants to borrow that later on. This was a project which I initiated as part of what the work I'm doing for Sutta Central, and we're trying to get a complete digital translation of all the early Buddhist texts, and the Theragatha is one of the collections, which is both I think a really wonderful collection, and also unfortunately there's no digital version available currently, so I thought it was a worthwhile thing to do. So when my student then Nivida approached me asking for a project to help learn Pali, then being the completely selfish person that I am, I said, why don't you do that because it will be good for me, not because it's good for her learning Pali, because it's a ridiculous project to do if you want to learn Pali, because it's not really hard. No. So don't study the Theragatha if you want to learn Pali. Anyway, she went and did a rendering of it from the Pali, and also using K.R. Norman's translation. And those of you who might be familiar with Pali translations will know that K.R. Norman was the president of the Pali Text Society for many years. And he did translate, I think he must have translated pretty much all of the verses in the early Buddhist texts, or the early Pali texts. And he was probably the greatest linguist, Indological linguist, that the modern times have thrown up. But he's much better at Pali than he is at English, unfortunately. And it seems to be a peculiarity of linguists that they are good at all the other languages except for the language they're actually talking or writing in. But anyone who's done any translation will know that actually most of the time when you're doing translation, the language you actually need, that a hard part is the language you're translating into, not the language you're translating from. You know, it's much easier to hear something and understand it, right, than it is to write it and express it yourself. Yeah? So most of the time, the problems you have in translation are not linguistic problems. In some cases, obviously, they are, but most of the time it's not a linguistic problem. Most of the time, the biggest problem is how do we actually express that in modern English. And so I won't go into too much of the background in that, but just to say my aim was to write something which was in my mind, I kind of was thinking of like an Aussie translation, right? By which I mean kind of like bright sunshine, and things are kind of clear and a bit kind of straightforward and direct, and not too much of this kind of arty farty intellectual European nonsense, right? But more just kind of plain language. Anyway. So that was my aim. So what I'd like to do, and again I'm being completely selfish here, is to get some verses and get some feedback if you like it or you don't like it or something. I haven't chosen any so far, so I'm open to, you know, open to taking requests as I did in my last content. Any feedback about the translation and so on would be most helpful, particularly just, you know, if you're reading it or whatever, if you find anything that's obscure or problematic, or you don't know why I've done things certain ways, then I'd love to hear that. My aim is to make everything as transparent as possible so you can just read it and you know what it means. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Sugugi. My little hut is roofed and pleasant, sheltered from the wind. So rain, sky, if you wish. My mind is serene and liberated. I practice ardently. Rain, sky. So this to me is the first verse. There's no particular reason for it being the first one, but to me it really captures something of the essence of the Theragatha. And when I think of the Theragatha, I think of verses like that. And it really kind of, you know, it always kind of just feels to me just like as a monk, I just know that feeling so well. Right? You're sitting in your little hut there in the middle of the night and For some reason, I always feel really good, you know, just the other day when there was a big thunderstorm at night time, and you're sitting there in your little hut, and it's raining down everywhere, and you're thinking, oh, all I have is this little hut. And it's fine, rain as much as you like. And I just sit here, do my meditation, and that's all, that's fine. What about the word ardently? Is that a good word? Practice ardently. Is that like a word that people use in actual language?
Aussie.
Probably say in August. In Auslish.
Chilling out.
It's kind of the opposite of chilling out. I'm practicing hard, yeah.
I'll give it a crack.
By saying out was an Aussie translation, I wasn't quite meaning that. You know, the Buddha's like, being said, hey mate, instead of saying monks. No, I didn't mean kind of colloquial Aussie like that, but anyway.
Delicious.
Delicious, is that good?
That's good.
What is the Pali word?
I think it's Atapi.
Atapi? Oh, okay, that's a Buddhist translation for Atapi,
So I kind of sometimes get bigger Buddhist translations and sometimes change them. I didn't have a particular policy on that.
I think the reason he chose that word is because the idea of ardent has a kind of fiery cycle, just like Atapi has, like burning things away.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
So it's actually the etymological relationship, or at least meaning relationship, semantic relationship.
Exactly,
Each of the two. Yeah. That's why,
So I would accept ardent also means passionately in love, that's probably the more common use of it. Yeah, just love someone ardently.
Oh, ardent, that sense, ardently, but strongly, right.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm just going to pick out a few verses more or less at random. The fourth verse, Puma. You should only associate with the wise, those intent on good, seeing the goal, being wise, heedful and discerning. They realize the goal so great and profound, hard to see, subtle and fine. Next verse by so this gives you like some of the different voices that you're finding in the Theravada. Each verse is in one sense supposed to be theoretically kind of spoken by that monk, right? But actually they're not really. Sometimes they might be spoken by that monk, sometimes they might be spoken to them, and sometimes it's not entirely clear. Like that particular verse sounds to me like it was Puna probably teaching somebody. But it might not have been, it might have been somebody teaching Puna. And the next one is another example of that. So the verse of Dabba. Once hard to tame, now tamed themselves, worthy, content, crossed over doubt, victorious with fears vanished, Dabba is steadfast and has realized Nibbana. Okay, so in that verse, it's obviously an enlightenment verse, again very characteristic of the Theravada, expressing his feelings of enlightenment. But it's not entirely sure, is it actually Dabba speaking? Dabba's referred to in the third person there. Is that actually Dabba saying this and referring to himself in the third person? Or is it somebody saying that about Dabba? Perhaps the Buddha saying it about it, or one of the other monks saying it about Dabba. So there are many verses like that where it's not entirely clear to me who exactly the author is. Okay, the monk who went to Sitawana, the cool grove, is alone. This is the verse of Sitawaniya, which just means the monk who was living in Sitawana. The monk who went to Sitawana is alone, content, practicing samadhi, victorious, with goosebumps vanished, guarding mindfulness of the body, resolute. Okay, so there's a few points on that one. So Sitawana is one of the cool grove, one of the forests around there. Again, it's not entirely clear really who the author is. It seems to me likely in this case that the name Sitawaniya was probably just given to the verse. They probably didn't know who the monk was, but it mentioned Sitawana, so they just said, oh, it must have been the monk who was in Sitawana, so they call it Sitawaniya. When I'm translating, I usually keep samadhi as just samadhi and jhana as just jhana. Sometimes I use serenity for samadhi, but I've given up completely using concentration for samadhi. Goosebumps. And you have this Pali idiom where you have like the loma hansa, like the hairs rising up on your body. And actually what you say in English is goosebumps. So I'll put goosebumps in. One of the things I found difficult to do when trying to do a kind of a fluid translation was that a lot of the verses, like this one, a lot of it is just like a list of epithets. You know, it's not like a sort of a fluently constructed sentence, you know, like you find in prose. So it's just like a list of descriptive epithets of that monk. And so it's not easy to render it into a smooth sentence. The verse of Balinga Vachan. It was welcome, not unwelcome. The advice I got was good. Of things which are shared, I encountered the best. So, for me, that's quite an interesting verse. It's one of the ones that's a bit difficult to render. And it's one which is repeated a number of times in the Theragata. And it's a verse which calls out for some context, right? Obviously, something has happened, and he's saying this. It was welcome, not unwelcome. The advice I got was good. So presumably it's a monk who's maybe done something wrong or didn't know how to do something or something like that, and then got some advice or some instruction or some encouragement from one of the other monks. Of things which are shared, I encountered the best. That's a very nice idea, right? So the idea like living in a community, living in a sangha, so that's one of the things that we can share with each other. Right? So you can share water and food and roads and all those physical things, but being able to share support and encouragement through our words is the best thing that we can give to each other.
It sounds like it means the Dhamma there, of things that I encountered, I found the best. It sounds like it's just the Dhamma basically, the teaching of the Buddha.
It's
the kind of feeling you get right here. Hear that?
Yeah, from the first verse, yes, I think it is the Dhamma, but I think it's a bit more specific. I think it was like an Avada in a particular context. So he like got, I think one part of the word is there. That's what I thought that meant. It meant that he'd actually been admonished or got some advice on a particular issue,
right,
rather than just hearing the Dhamma generally. But yeah, maybe you're right on. Maybe it means Dhamma generally. Swagatam. Pagatam. Swagatam na pagatam na itam dumankitam mama. And so dumankitam, which literally means kind of advised or something you'd use rather than just a Dhamma talk generally. Dumankitam. Sangi bhadesu dhamme so yam septam tarupagaminti. Another typical verse from the Theragata. A monk with much joy in the Dhamma spoken or taught by the Buddha would realize the peaceful state, the stilling of activities, bliss. So this is something that you find again and again and again through the Theragata, so much so that it actually becomes a problem of translation is like how much joy all of these monks are having. Because they refer to it so often and with so many different words, like rati and pamoja and sukha and all of these, it's hard to find enough words in English that are happy enough to convey the happiness that all of these monks have. And if you're in these verses again and again and again, you know, these verses are very much speaking from that place of happiness and from just being so content to find that happiness. We do find also, another thing which is interesting is the monks who are struggling, so that's also there as well, but the vast majority of it, they're pretty happy. One of Acha, 1.13. They look like blue-black storm clouds glistening, cooled with the waters of clear flowing streams and covered with ladybird beetles. These rocky crags delight me. So again, this is one of those verses which to me is really kind of sums up one of the very characteristic things in the Theragata is these nature verses. And you find these many of the monks saying similar kinds of things and sometimes much more extensively. speaking from that experience, huh? And that's where these monks are living, in these beautiful places in the forest. Yeah? If you've been to around Rajagahar, you look at all of the bare hills on Rajagahar, you think once upon a time there were trees. And it really would have been cool groves and forests, and now it's baking hard rock and sand. But anyway, so this also, I think, it's such an important part of understanding the experience and the voice from which these monks are talking about. You know, when we look at the suttas, it's very easy sometimes to just take it purely, you know, look at what is the doctrine, teachings, or what is the ideas that are taught, and so on. And it can get very abstract. And always have to remember that these things are taught in a particular time and place, to a particular person or group of people, and it had a meaning for that person at that time and that place. And that is just bound up so much with the experience that they had, that experience of being in nature, and so much joy that they got from it. I'm getting a few where in most of these, or the first line of the verse is missing. That's bad, isn't it? Just on the front part, yeah. In fact, it's looking like just about everyone from here on in is missing the first line.
Sorry about that. Oops. No, some of the
no idea.
Well, I'm missing, so I reprinted them.
Yeah. I have no idea why that would happen, but anyway.
I've got an electronic version if you can.
And after a while it gets a bit recovers, so just had a bit of a sleep. Lazy times. Okay. Alright, so we'll skip over the rest of the ones, but those are two, so make it okay. Okay, so here's the verse of Bhavya. This one is a bit hard to translate. A monkey went up to the little hut with five doors. He circles around knocking on each door again and again. Stand still, monkey. Don't run. Things are different now. You've been caught by wisdom. You won't go far. Obviously, again, speaking to the experience of the monks living with the monkeys in the forest, perhaps meant as a metaphor. The difference of sense doors, you reckon?
Yeah.
It's not just talking about a monkey hassling him in his hut. I'm all about that. Right? Yeah? But anyway, yes, that's the, I assume that's the metaphor. Circling around, knocking on each door again and again. Stand still. Don't run. Things are different now. So that's how I translated that. Actually, the Pali idiom is something like, as it was, now it is not, or something like that. So I try to put that more idiomatically. You won't go far. So this is Ganga Girya, another monk, the one where the verse is just named after the location. So Ganga Girya just means the monk who's living on the bank of the Ganges. My hut on the bank of the Ganges is made from three palm leaves. My alms bowl is a funeral pot. My robe is cast off rags. In the first two rainy seasons, I spoke only one word. In my third rainy season, the mass of darkness was torn apart. So there's some hardcore practice going on there, right? Okay? So my heart on the bank of the Ganges is making three palm leaves. That's not much for a heart. I hope there are more leaves. Palm's bowl made from a funeral pot, right? So I don't know, they must have got like bones or something like that and put them in a bowl or something. Robes, cast off rags. And I wasn't quite sure what this next verse is. It actually just uses the word vasani, which can either mean like a rainy season or actually a year. It's sometimes used as an idiom to mean a whole year. So I'm not sure whether it meant in the first two rains retreats or for the first 2 years I spoke only one word. But I took the kind of the less extreme example, but perhaps actually what it means is my first 2 years I only spoke one word. So it wasn't keeping a vow of silence, Right? You still speak, but only when absolutely necessary. You know there's that old joke about the monk who's keeping the vow of silence, you know, in the Christian monastery? You must know that. No? The monk is only allowed to say one sentence per year, and then he came up to the abbot at the end of the first year and says, okay, you've got one sentence. He says, the food's lousy. He comes at the end of the second year, he says, okay, what have you got to say? He says, oh, it's really cold here. And then as the third year, he comes up and says, I'm going to disrobe. And the abbot says, well, thank God you've done nothing but complain the whole time. Anyway, that's probably not the one word that this monk said. 2 year period, I guess.
My Malaysian monk in Nauna, who didn't speak for 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Only two teachers he spoke on interviews.
Yeah.
Completely vanished.
Yeah.
He was there, and I thought, once I was in my copy, and I thought, this monk must have left.
Uh-huh.
I thought, I haven't seen him for, I think, three months. Then next day I looked in the dining hall, and he was still there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's possible.
It is possible, yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, these things are not, you know, they sound like they're really extreme or whatever, but actually, yeah. Okay, another verse. This is the verse of Ajina. Even someone with the three knowledges who has conquered death and that is without defilements is looked down for being unknown by fools without wisdom. But a person who gets food and drink is honoured by them, even if they're a bad character. So when doing this translation, you know, the word I've translated there as defilements is actually asava. And usually what we do when we translate, for some reason, the word kilesa is always translated as defilements, and people use all kinds of strange renderings for asava, like fermentations and taints and all of these kinds of things. But actually the word kilesa is hardly ever found in the suttas in a general sense of defilements. It's usually used as upakilesa, just a synonym for the five hindrances. But it's only rarely that you find the word kilesa as a general term for defilements. I don't think, like, in the Theravada, you don't find it at all. Whereas asavas is used all the time. So I thought maybe better just use defilements for asavas.
I was reading the translation earlier, and it says quite often it mentions the three knowledges.
Yeah.
But do you say anywhere what the three knowledges are, what that means?
They're not defined in the text, but the three knowledges are the recollection of past lives, knowledge of seeing beings reborn according to their karma, and then the ending of defilements.
I don't know if you included it at the end anywhere, but this might be a helpful thing for the average reader.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things there are some technical terms, obviously, that you can't understand without having some explanation. Yeah. So, on the whole, I tried to translate it so that, you know, so you wouldn't have to do that. But yeah, there are some cases where you have to. Yeah. Hopefully not that many, and some of these are very kind of standard document terms. Yeah. But this, I mean, the aim would ultimately be to do a translation where you just don't need glossaries or footnotes or anything. But in that case, sometimes you look at it and you think, how can I, you know, can you actually translate it, say that the three knowledges, i.e. the knowledge of X, Y, Z, you can't really put that in the translation and make it too clumsy. But yeah. Anyway. Okay, here's another one where there was a translation issue. This is Surada. Rebirth is ended for me. The conqueror's instruction is fulfilled. What they call a net is abandoned. The attachment to being reborn in any state of existence is undone. I've arrived at the goal, for the sake of which I went forth from the home life into homelessness, the ending of all fetters. So this is something which really struck me when I was doing this translation. We have this word in Pali called bhava, and bhava literally means existence or being. Bhikkhu Bodhi these days translates it as existence. What it really means is getting reborn in some state of being or some state of existence. And when you say nati dani puna bhava, it means now I'm not going to get reborn again, right? But then when you translate it, now there is no more existence for me, right? The literal translation. Now there is no more existence. What does that actually mean? now I don't exist anymore. Well, what do you mean you don't exist anymore? And you read it, and I remember sort of looking at these things, and it takes ages to figure out actually what the thing is meaning. And you're almost forced, if you translate it, now there is no more existence for me, you're sort of almost forced to make some kind of philosophical interpretation out of it. You know, you're there, but you're not really there, you're kind of there, but you're not self, so you're empty, and so on. But it doesn't mean those things at all. Actually, all it means is you're not going to get reborn, and that's just the idiom that they use to express that. And so there's quite a few words which you find in Pali, which just have that meaning or that idiom of talking about being reborn. And when they're translated, that meaning just doesn't come across, and so they're very open to being read in different kind of ways. So I try to make that much more explicit. So the attachment to being reborn in any state of existence is undone. So the Pali is Bhavaneti Samuhata. So it's much more kind of longer translation. I don't know, what do you think of that? Is that a good idea, or does that work?
Where is Metti? Metti there, what is that?
Metti is like a string.
Yeah, no, but what is your...
attachment.
Attachment.
Yeah.
But I think we keep what you're trying to say. It's Bhavaneti as a conduit to existence.
Even conduit, I'm not even sure. I mean, it's obscure, but I'm not even sure that's accurate. I think the underlying idea of the Bhavaneti, you know, you have these kind of stories sometimes where you see people who actually see rebirth as being like a string. Yeah, it's like a string that people can actually visualize. I know in one of Ajahn Mun's stories, for example, he talks about that. It might be a string that actually hooks consciousness on. And I think it actually stems from that. This is actually almost like a literal vision which some people can get, where you see almost like a psychic vision of a string. But anyway, that's the idea, is that there's something connecting. The Bhavaneti, the conduit to existence, of course, just means craving. That's why I used attachment, so hopefully it keeps that idea as something that ties one life onto the next.
Maybe
you can put
that. The string of life which attaches you to this.
That's right, yeah. I went through a Birmingham thing there. I'm trying to use life for Bhava. Actually, life isn't a bad translation for Bhava, right? So future, that's normally what we say, isn't it? Like past lives and future lives, right? But then it kind of it sounds a bit problematic when you say, oh, I don't have any attachment to life anymore, right? Oh, I'm practicing in order to annihilate all life, right?
That's a problem. That's a good one. That's great.
I understand it, but yeah, I'm not sure how it's going to come across. Yeah.
I think it's difficult to have written on something like this because... you know, many of these might have heard the teachings of the Buddha at the time, and they probably discussed the Dharma, and they had, I guess, a certain set of concepts that they would use. I'm sure even some of these exclamations, you know, like we are the Pachamaramas in terms of talking about the driverless bus. So if one of us reaches enlightenment and we say, oh, joy the driverless bus, you know, somebody reading about that 100 years ago, what they're talking about.
So, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so that has to be in there also somehow, that there's a vocabulary that they were sharing that we don't have access to.
Yeah. Obviously, there needs to be that kind of discussion and explanation of things. I'm not sure that footnotes are the best way of doing that. The problem that I have with footnotes, which I feel like a growing unease with the idea of footnotes over the past few years, is that essentially it creates an authoritative voice, whereby the translator has a uniquely authoritative voice on the text. And I don't think that's the case, except obviously in cases where the translators explain why they translated something a certain way, right? In that case, obviously they do have a unique authority. But normally, the translator doesn't have a unique authority on the text. When I've been dealing with a lot of different texts, which is sort of central, you realise that actually a lot of the things that a lot of people are putting in footnotes are actually just rubbish. Or they're just wrong, or they're irrelevant, or they're just confused, or they're dubious, or they're at the very least capable of being interpreted in another way. And so Which is fine, right? That's humanity, right? We say things and, you know, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad, right? But, so this my problem is to not create that sort of sense of uniquely authoritative voice. So that would be, my idea is to leave these footnotes out of the text, but then you can have a separate thing, which may be an essay where someone says, now I'm going to discuss these sutras, or, you know, here's my glossary for these sutras, or something like that. And then you can see, well, it's just, you know, one person's perspective on them. Yeah. So that's kind of the approach I'm taking.
Would you put that simile right back, just a note on the page under that verse, so it's still included in the text rather than at the back? You could. I just think that simile is quite rich with the string, so even though we capture the meaning, which is perfect, then you lose that simile in description, and it's quite good.
Yeah, the other problem with footnotes, and part of it is that problem of authority, the other problem is the problem of immersion. Like when you're reading something, it doesn't actually apply so much in these cases because they're just kind of very short and so on. But when you're reading something, especially getting into longer suttas, there's a sense where you can actually sort of really get into it. You know, you become absorbed into it, and so on. And like footnotes, to me, reading something with footnotes is like you're sitting there listening to a Dhamma talk, and then there's a monk who's sitting beside you who's sort of nudging you and saying, actually, what that means is this. And you're kind of taken out of the flow. And it seems to me that we have so many things that are already doing that, right? More and more and more things that are already wanting to take us out of the flow. So again, my idea is to try to just... Here's the thing, just be with that. And then later on, and there's time for doing what we're doing today to discuss it and to, you know, look at the terminology and so on. Yeah. To try and keep those kind of separate experiences. Yeah. Anyway, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I noticed that in some of the modern books, they don't actually have footnotes. What they have instead, they have a big section at the back, yeah, which actually refers to certain passages in the in the text.
Right.
So if it's something you're certain about, you can actually look at the back if there's any reference there to what you're reading about. But it's actually not actually, the text itself isn't actually stopped by any kind of marker or anything like that. Yeah.
That's actually quite a nice way of doing it.
So if you have it back, particularly in this case, you could have a glossary, or don't even have to have a glossary, you can have like a reference point which takes you to a place where this particular concept is discussed. Yeah. Like if Vichai is very easy,
yeah,
you can just have a reference point to click onto something, yeah, which takes you to any sutta which explains the idea of Vichai.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Explain
what I think.
Yeah.
I mean, in that case, it's not controversial, but
not at all,
in
yeah,
a lot of cases, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so this is also quite an interesting one to try to translate. This is the early verses of Vasava. First, one kills oneself. Actually, I should translate, you don't need one. I can't get rid of all the ones, I have to do that before I've done them. You never say one in English. First you kill yourself, then you kill others. You kill yourself really dead, like someone who kills birds using a dead bird as a decoy.
Yeah.
So now this image is very hard. This is a very difficult verse, and that's only kind of a tentative translation, really. Anyway, a holy man's colour is not on the outside. A holy man is coloured on the inside. Whoever does bad deeds, such a one is truly dark, Sujumpati. Okay? So another interesting thing. So first of all, the interesting first verse. First you kill yourself, then you kill others. You kill yourself really dead, like one who kills birds using a dead bird as a decoy. How do you kill birds, right? First you kill a bird. I'm going to kill a bird in order to kill others, right? So, yeah. I don't think it's instructions on how to do murder. I think it's... I think it's a... anyone got any ideas what it means? I just translated it, I don't know.
Probably just means that...
Like if you realise not yourself and then you teach the Dharma, then this is the thing. But
so you're taking killing in a positive sense?
Well, it's like you are the dead bird, you know? So it's like you are this kind of... you're not really yourself anymore.
Okay.
And then when you teach the Dharma, it's kind of like other people, kind of killing other people's sense of self. As you are a dead bird attracting other birds.
Okay. I mean, when I read it, I took it in a negative sense, that you're destroying yourself by doing your bad conduct or something, and you're destroying yourself and destroying others, bringing others in. But you could also interpret it in a positive way as well. Yeah, that's the thing with poetry, isn't it?
Can you read it again?
Okay, first you kill yourself, then you kill others. You kill yourself really dead. Like someone who kills birds using a dead bird as a decoy.
You kill yourself really dead?
Really dead, yeah. not just a little bit dead. Suhatan, panki, atana. So Suhatan, well dead. Ube hananti atana. Pacha hananti sopare. Suhatan hanti atana. Vitan se ne vapakima.
Hanti. Doesn't have to mean die, hatana. No. Like destroy or something like that.
Yeah.
So you can mean to destroy yourself.
For the last one, so we're talking about using a decoy for hunting.
Yeah.
And that's probably more literally killing. But yeah, I did rely on Norman's discussion and the commentary. But you're right, Hanati could be just to destroy something. In the next verse, I used holy man for Brahman. Is that good?
There's another Indian mystic, I forgot his name. It's about killing the defilements.
Huh?
Yeah, it's sort of, I think,
in Jewish and Indian mysticism. Yeah. So I think it probably can be read both ways. It's either about, first of all, getting rid of your defilements, and then you can help others get rid of their defilements.
Yeah.
Or else it could mean that if you go down a bad way and do bad things, and you're subject to death, and you also drag along others with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the next verse, a holy man's colour is not on the outside, a holy man is coloured on the inside. So I used holy man for Brahman here. Yes. Is that a good translation of Brahman? Sometimes I use Brahman more specific, just kept it as Brahman. But in cases like that, is that right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, holy man.
Mm-hmm.
The meaning comes across.
And it's actually almost too precise, actually, holy man. The word Brahman comes, the original root of the word Brahman seems to be what we sometimes use in anthropological terms, they call mana, which is a Polynesian word, meaning something like magical power. And so Brahma means something like the original root of it means something like the force of life, or the power of the universe, which is kind of wielded by I guess in those days maybe the witch doctor or something like that, right? So it's this power powers you up, and the word holy I think also has a similar root meaning, it's kind of idea of power. Whoever does bad deeds, such a one is truly dark, Sujampati. So right at the end we learn this is being addressed to a certain Sujampati, so I'm not quite sure who Sujampati is. There's a Brahma called Sujampati.
That's a Sujampati.
I think isn't there a Sujampati as well? Well, maybe it's a variant spelling. I think there's a Brahma Sujampati as well as a Sujampati. But I'm not sure whether that's meant to be the Brahmas being addressed, or whether it's just somebody happens to be called Sujampati. So you do with these as is normal in Pali verse. The verse itself was never meant to be read in isolation. It always had its context. And always we find that in Buddhist verses, that in the Jatakas, the Dhammapada verses and so on, they're always passed down with some kind of narrative context. There may be some exceptions to that, especially when you get into longer sets of verses which are more kind of self-contained. But usually the verses had some kind of narrative context, and they would have been spoken and passed down in that way, like there'd be some narrative around it and then the verse. But the problem, of course, is that in the form we have it today, that narrative is supplied by the commentary, which is only written 1,000 years later. So most of the time, the commentarial story is not really very reliable. In some cases, maybe it is, but most of the time it doesn't seem to be. If you're interested to look at the commentary story, I think in the early PTS translations, which I'm not sure if we have here. Do we have a Rhys Davids translation? I think we might have them upstairs. But the early PTS translation actually translated or sort of summarized the commentary as well as the verse. And in addition to Pali proper names, if you look under the name of the monk who's mentioned here, you'll always find that he'll give a summary of the story and the commentary as well. So if you're interested to know something about the context, they're your main sources. Okay, here's another one. This is a bit cynical. Sabbamita. Okay, cynical or almost ironic, I guess, given his name. Sabbamita, the friend of everybody. Sabbamita. People are attached to people. People are dependent on people. People are hurt by people, and people hurt people. What's the point of people or the things people produce? Go, leave these people who've hurt so many people. And so he calls himself the friend of everyone. Again, you know, you can see we don't know what the context is of that. Like Sabbamita, like a lot of these monks are not found anywhere else, right? This is the only reference we have to them. But then, I mean, there must be something behind that, right? I mean, obviously being hurt. Yeah. Okay, next one. This is one of my favorite ones. This is the Mahakala. Big black. And there's a big black woman who looks like a crow. She broke off thigh bones, first one, then another. She broke off arm bones, first one, then another. She broke off a skull like a curd bowl, and then she assembled them all together and sat down beside them. When an ignorant person builds up attachments, the idiot returns to suffering again and again. So let one who understands not build up attachments. May I never again lie with a broken skull. Cool. Huh? So, big black woman who looks like a crow. Huh? So this is obviously some kind of what looks like some kind of ascetic charnel ground practice, right? You still find the ascetics in India doing today, and the Agora ascetics and other ones. If you want to be really freaked out by hardcore ascetics, then you can go onto YouTube and just search for Agora ascetics, and yeah, they do some pretty outrageous kind of things. But this one's relatively mild in comparison. From the description, I mean, it sounds like she's actually like she broke off thigh bones first, one then another, arm bones then one then another, and then the skull. So she's actually like assembling a skeleton, right? So she's going around to all the different, you know, bones and discarded skeletons there and breaking them all off and then assembling a kind of a person out of all of these bits, right? And then sit down beside him, presumably to, I don't know, meditate or contemplate or something, we're not really sure. But that's some kind of practice. And this is actually quite unusual. It's a disputed area in Indology. There was some articles by Richard Gombrich discussed this some time ago. These practices are very common in contemporary Hinduism, and there was some debate about whether they're found in earlier forms of Indian religious practice. We don't find them mentioned, I don't think, in the Upanishads. And so Gombrich was actually referring to this specific verse and one or two others in the Tara and Tarikata as evidence that these kinds of practices were current in the time of the Buddha. And he argued also that that was probably who Angulimala was, that he was probably an ascetic who was doing this kind of practice and then actually wearing the finger bones around his neck. So this is an interesting one, which I don't know whether this might be taken to reflect on recent past history of Bodhinyana Monastery. But anyway, when your head is shaven and you're wrapped in the outer robe, you'll have many enemies when you receive food and drink, clothes and lodgings. Knowing this danger, this great fear in honours, a monk should go forth mindfully with few possessions and not full of desire. Right, so this is a kind of warning. If you're a monk and you go around with lots of stuff and you get really well provided for, like we are here in Bodhinyana, and we've got nice kutis and nice robes to wear and really good food to eat every day and things like that, then you attract a lot of jealousy and a lot of people, and even some monks who maybe have get envious or jealous, and so you become a target for criticism like that. But if you live very simply and you say, okay, whatever, these things don't touch you, then that's not going to matter to you at all. That's why I think it's a good thing, like here, most of the monks here, just sort of starting out and being around for a year or two, and after you've been around for a while, it'd be good to do some travelling and to, go and stay in some places where you just don't have anything. And just say, just go and stay in a monastery, simple monastery in Sri Lanka or Thailand or whatever, Burma, and just know what that's like, and just travel with a bowl and rugs, and just have like a heart made out of three palm leaves or whatever.
Don't
speak for 2 years, yeah, and hang around in Thailand grounds and stuff. Whatever, it doesn't have to be like outrageously ascetic, but you just have to, until you've done that and you know what it's like, then you never really know. How much are you attached to having a nice hut to go back to? How much are you attached to having Uncle Brian come along and make you feel happy in the morning, right? And how much, all these things you get used to. And so you don't really know until you've tested yourself. So this next one is from Nanda. Of course, we know Nanda being the cousin of the Buddha, cousin, I think.
Half brother,
yeah. In the depending on the dubious and little known understanding of family relations in the Satya. So anyway, half brother of the Buddha. I used my mind unwisely. I was addicted to ornamentation. I was vain, fickle, tormented by desire for sensual pleasures. But with the help of the Buddha, the kinsman of the sun, so skilled in means, I practiced wisely and extracted any attachment to being reborn from my mind. Okay, next one is Hirimaha. If they praise someone who doesn't have samadhi, the praise is in vain, as they don't have samadhi. If they rebuke someone who does have samadhi, the rebuke is in vain, as they do have samadhi. Right? Pretty straightforward, but very nice sentiment. And so this next one is Babaji. And this was an extremely difficult one to translate. It was one of the few that I actually had to do a bit of research and so on to find out. I had not the slightest clue what I was talking about. But here it goes. That king was named Panada, whose sacrificial post was golden. Its height was 16 times its width, and the top was 1,000-fold, with 1,000 panels and 100 ball caps adorned with banners made of gold. There, the 7 times 600 gods of music danced. Okay? Now, that's obviously a slightly different kind of flavour than we're getting from most of the verses here. Okay? Nothing about staying in my little hut and meditating while the rain falls down or anything like that. Seems to be referring to, I don't know, a Jataka perhaps, or a folk tale of some kind, some story. A king named Panada. I don't know who King Panada was. And in Norman's translation, it really seemed to kind of not convey the point of it all. Like you had this idea like the yuka, which is a sacrificial post that's used in the Brahmanical sacrifices. And so I had to go back and try to look at pictures of what these sacrificial posts looked like, because it was very difficult to figure out actually how the verse was constructed and what it means. But the idea was that this is usually for the horse sacrifice. And so the horse sacrifice is intended to establish sovereignty over a country, right? So this is for a king doing a sacrifice, probably a horse sacrifice, although it doesn't actually say that. And so you set up a post, which would be like a tree trunk that you chop down for the occasion, decorate it and so on. And so the descriptions of the Brahmanical rituals are actually very much like this. So you decorate it with gold and you hang it with banners and so on. And you can see actual pictures in ancient coins of doing this sacrifice with the actual banners hanging off the things. And the ball caps is like at the top of the post, they would have like a cap with a ring through it that they tie the horse onto. Right? So this one says that they have like 100 ball caps. Actually, they usually just have one, but this is obviously exaggerated for mythical purposes. But that's what the ball cap is. It's where you actually tie the horse on who's going to be sacrificed in the horse sacrifice. And so there the 7 times 600 gods of music dance, so that's the Gandharvas, were dancing at the sacrifice. So what exactly the Dharma point of this is, I have no clue. But I presume that there probably would have been one in the story. So this again is one which sort of cries out for some kind of background story to give you some kind of meaning for it. Okay, here's another one, more straightforward. This one, Rita Soka. Who knows who Rita Soka is?
Kinga
Soka's brother, I think. Yeah, Kinga Soka's younger brother. So this, the period of composition of the Theravada goes up to the time of King Ashoka. So most of the monks that we know about lived in the time of the Buddha. A few of them lived later. A few of them seem to be from the verses that were written later, and this one being one example. But it seems to me likely that the bulk of them actually come from the time of the Buddha. Perhaps a few later on, like this one. The barber approached to shave my head. I picked up a mirror and looked at my body. My body looked vacant. I was blind, but the darkness left me. My fancy hairdo has been cut off. Now there is no more rebirth into any state of existence. Okay? So here's someone who's brought up as a prince in a kingly family. His father's coming along to do his hairdo. If you've seen the sculptures in Sanchi and places like that, you'll see that all of the lay people, especially the wealthy lay people, all have these incredibly fancy hairdos that they did. I mean, obviously the barber must have been quite a skilled profession in those days. And so here he's saying, now it's all been cut off, there's no more rebirth. So he obviously became a monk. Okay, here's another little one that has a bit of kind of a background to it. This is from Upavana. So Upavana was one of the monks who was an attendant for the Buddha, for Ananda. The worthy one, the world's holy one, the sage is afflicted by winds. If there's hot water, give it to the sage, Brahma. I wish to bring it to the one who's honoured by those worthy of honour, revered by those worthy of reverence, and respected by those worthy of respect. It's kind of a little episode that obviously the Buddha was sick, and so just a little verse saying, come on, get some hot water for the Buddha. Next one, Ichidina. I've seen lay disciples who have memorized discourses saying, sensual pleasures are impermanent, but they are passionately enamored of jeweled earrings, desiring children and wives. To be honest, they don't know Dhamma. Despite saying sensual pleasures are impermanent, they don't have the power to cut their lusts, so they're attached to children, wives, and wealth.
I wonder whether impermanent is the... this is anicca, presumably, impermanent, is that right?
Yeah. I guess so, yeah.
I wonder whether that is a case where unreliable might be more powerful than impermanent, then. Because, of course, are unreliable. Impermanent is kind of very... it's a bit philosophical almost, whereas unreliable is much more clear, much more, you know, much more kind of... I think more, perhaps more to the point.
Unreliable.
Yeah. This is one of the, you know, I think you mentioned this before as well on your little blog post about the your translation of this one. And you mentioned Ajahn Brahm, how he, you know, how he likes to use the ordinary words on the Vinaya and actually apply the ordinary meanings to the philosophical material as well, so to understand actually what lies behind it. And one of the interesting uses of the word Nietzsche, not Anicca, but Nietzsche, is as a regular meal, right?
Right.
It doesn't mean permanent, it means a regular meal.
Right.
And what is irregular is that which is unreliable, which is not reliable.
Yeah.
So I think there's a good case also in that sense to actually translate Anicca as unreliable rather than impermanent. Right?
Yeah.
Impermanent is very kind of a...
It is, it's kind of philosophical.
Philosophical.
So I think that basically, you know, if you look at the people who've translated texts into English, they're either Indologists or linguists or philosophers.
Right.
So they're really three main categories. So did anyone get that reference that Ramana was talking about, the regular meal? Like in the Vinaya you have a thing where a layperson can invite a monk to come for their dana or for something else, right? So you might have other kind of invitation. You might just do it on a one-off occasion, or you might say, you know, come to my house every day, or come to my house whenever you like, or something like that. And so that's called a Nicha Pavarana, or Nicha Bhata, is like a regular meal. So you're actually invited every day. So obviously it doesn't mean a permanent meal, it doesn't mean you're just eating non-stop for the rest of eternity. But it just means that you can rely on that. If you need that invitation, you can go there. So, yeah. Okay. Oh, someone, I've got a long way to go with this, but someone tell me the time to get an hour.
I don't want to take up too much time. But if you do read It's right at the end, because you read Tathagata.
I was thinking of doing that next week.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Tathagata is more substantive, yeah. Sure. But yeah, this is my favourite. Okay, here's another interesting one. Sona Pohtiria. Again, I don't know who Sona Pohtiria is apart from this. Night with its garland of stars is not just for sleeping. Those who are conscious will know that night is also for waking. If I'm going to fall from the back of an elephant and be trampled by the tuskers that follow, better for me to die in battle than to live on in defeat. Okay, here's another one. Usaba. Again, you've got to wonder about some of these names. Usaba being a kind of a poetic word for an elephant.
Bull.
Oh, it's someone for a bull. Bull. Sorry, you're right, bull. So Usaba must be... Oh, maybe it is his name. Usaba. Anyway. I arranged a robe on my shoulder, the colour of young mango sprouts. Okay, so it's a man who pays attention to the colour of his robes. Then I entered the village for alms while sitting on an elephant's neck. Right? So imagine that. You've got the nice mango colored robe on the back of an elephant going for alms. But when I dismounted from the elephant, I was moved by inspiration. First I was burning, but then I was peaceful. I realized the end of defilements. Okay? So... Yeah, so... Yeah, monks used to get up to all kinds of things in those days. I was moved by inspiration. So the Pali Sangvega is the term here. They often say a sense of urgency, but inspiration is good. I think awe is also quite a good one for Sangvega. I was awed. Anyway, but here he's, and so again, it's talking about the emotional kind of response. It can happen any time. This again is one of the things I think which is very characteristic of the Tathagata and the Tathagata, is it shows how just spontaneous and unpredictable these things are, right? And often when you look at the suttas, when the Buddha just sort of sits down there and says yes, and then here a monk sort of shaves off his hair and beard and he goes forth and he takes the silas and then he goes into town for alms and he comes back and he sits there in jhanas and he gets into the four jhanas and then he recollects his past life and then boom, he's defilements are ended. And you think, wow, that's fantastic, you know? But he's showing, well, actually, it's not quite as straightforward as that, right? Things go in windy and unpredictable ways. And so here's this monk who, you know, and I think this is a really good reflection, actually, you know, to think, here's a monk who all the other monks would have been thinking, oh my god, there is a condemned really. And he's going along feeling so happy with himself in the back of the elephant. Oh my god. You can imagine what Kasapa was thinking of. And he's preparing another fiery discourse about how it was silent and declined. But then he gets enlightened. Okay, here's another interesting
thing. So, it's also overestimation.
Overestimation? You already thought he was a monk. Yeah.
I mean, you were saying those Thai monks in the private jet with their Louis Vuitton bags weren't actually doing the wrong thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
That line was impossible.
Go on.
That line, I think it's. There's a line at the end that says, like, sometimes it's translated as agitation, there's a fear, and then there's peace, and then there's enlightenment.
Uh-huh.
What's the part of that?
Do you remember? This one is, I think, unique.
Oh, that's a unique one. I don't think it occurs again.
Yeah.
It's like almost like a standard way of describing it, like a true set.
Yeah. And this one, I think, is a unique phrase. Yeah, soham ditto tada santo. Yeah, soham ditto tada santo. At first I was burning, then I was peaceful.
Aditto.
Yeah, just a short form of aditto. Well, it's all talking about your emotional response to the Dhamma rather than the kind of the theory of it, but how they actually felt about it. I mean, there was nothing actually happened, right? Nobody actually said anything to him or anything like that, but somehow that just came to him. Okay, next one, Kapatakura. This fellow, Rag Rice, he sure is a rag. This place has been made for practicing jhana, like a crystal vase filled to the brim with the nectar of the deathless, into which enough Dhamma has been poured. Don't nod off, Ran. I'll smack your ear. Don't knock in the middle of the Sangha. You haven't learned a thing. Okay? So here's Kaptakura is like, you know, here we are in this beautiful hall. It's all for here. Everything for practicing Dhamma and doing meditating. And all you're doing is sitting there falling asleep. Watch out. Give you a whack. Someone. So this is the verses of Mogaraja, first one, verse 2 Mogaraja. Your skin is nasty, but your heart is good. Mogaraja, you always have samadhi, but in the nights of winter, so dark and cold, how will you get by, monk? To which Mogaraja replies, I've heard that all the Magadans have an abundance of grain. I'll make my bed under a thatched roof, just like those who live in comfort. So, not a very charming way of addressing the monk, is it? Anyway. Okay, so the next one is Visakha Panchalabhuta. This is a couple of verses talking about behavior, particularly behavior in Sangha and Sangha meetings. One should not suspend others from the Sangha, nor raise objections against them, and neither disparage nor raise one's voice against one who has crossed to the farther shore. One should not praise oneself among the assemblies, but be without conceit, measured in speech and of good conduct. For one who sees the goals, the very subtle and fine, who has wholesome thoughts and humbleness and cultivates the Buddha's ethical conduct, it's not hard to gain Nibbana. Okay, this is the verses. Anupama. Anupama, the incomparable. The conceited mind, addicted to pleasure, impales itself on its own stake. It only goes where there's a stake, a chopping block. I declare you the demon mind. I declare you the insidious mind. You've found the teacher so hard to find. Don't lead me away from the goal. And so here, like the verse of Talaputta, he's addressing his mind in like a you mind, you demon. Right? You found the teacher, so just don't take me away. Okay, Pachaya from the threes. I went forth 5 days ago, training with my heart's goal unfulfilled. I entered my dwelling and an aspiration arose in my mind. I won't eat, I won't drink, I won't leave my dwelling, nor will I lie down on my side until the dart of craving is pulled out. See my energy and effort as I practice this way. I've attained the three knowledges and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. Huh? Okay. So the verses of Yasoja, with knobbly knees, thin, with veins matted on his skin, eating and drinking in moderation, this person's spirit is undaunted. Pestered by gadflies and mosquitoes in the awesome wilderness, one should mindfully endure, like an elephant in the head of the battle. A monk alone is like Brahma. A pair of monks are like devas. Three are like a village, and more than that is a rabble. Right? So one monk is like Brahma, two like devas, three is a village, and more than that is a rabble. Don't take it personally. Okay, here's another one, which probably is reminiscent of some of our experiences practicing during the rain retreat. Bhagu. Overwhelmed by drowsiness, I came out of my dwelling. Stepping up onto the walking meditation path, I fell to the ground right there. Has anyone ever done that? Anyone ever fallen asleep on meditating? What was it, walking meditation?
Yeah.
I don't know, one time I was at Nanashara, I used to walk meditation in the morning meetings, like sometimes at the back of the hall. And I remember one time I was walking at the back of the hall, and then I just kind of came to on the other side of the hall, nearly bumping into somebody else who was walking meditation. I just fell asleep and slept all the time.
Sleepwalking.
I rubbed my limbs, and again I stepped up on the walking meditation path. I walked up and down the path, serene inside myself. And then the realization came upon me, the danger became clear, and I was firmly repulsed. Nibbida. Then my mind was liberated. See the excellence of the Dhamma. I have attained the three knowledges and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. So that last part is a verse that we find repeatedly through the Theravada. Nandaka. Damn these stinking bodies. They're on Mara's side. They ooze. And bodies have nine streams that are always flowing. Don't think much of bodies. Don't disparage their Tathagatas. They're not even aroused by heaven, let alone by humans. But those dumb fools with bad advisors, shrouded in delusion, that kind of person is aroused by bodies when Mara has thrown the snare. Those who have discarded lust, hatred and ignorance, they've cut the strings, they're no longer bound. Such people are not aroused by bodies. So you have this Pali idiom, dihiratu, which is like a curse, this, or sometimes they translate fire on these sinking bodies, so damn your bodies will be burned. Jambuka. For 55 years, I wore mud and dirt. Eating one meal a month, I tore out my hair and beard. Right. Obviously a Jain ascetic, right? So these are classic Jain practices. You don't wash, you tear out your hair and beard, restrict your eating. I stood on one foot. I rejected seats. I ate dried out dung. I didn't accept food that had been set aside for me. Right? So this that last one, I mean, that is just requires a word of explanation. What that means is that if somebody has like prepared food to offer you on alms round, you go into the village grounds and someone sort of has made some food for you, then you say, no, I can't accept that. Right? So you can only accept food that's been randomly given by someone who didn't know you're coming. Having done many actions of this kind which lead to a bad destination, as I was being swept away by the great flood, I went to the Buddha for refuge. See the going for refuge. See the excellence of the Dhamma. I've attained the three knowledges and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. Okay, so I might just do one more call this evening. We'll see how we go. Okay, so this is another nice one. This is Sapaka. And this was, Sapaka means, apparently means snaky. Serpentine, perhaps. When the crane with its beautiful white wings, startled by fear of the dark thundercloud, flees seeking shelter, then the river Ajikarani delights me. When the crane so pure and white, startled by fear of the dark thundercloud, seeks for a cave to shelter in, but can't see one, then the river Ajikarani delights me. Who wouldn't be delighted by the rose apple trees that adorn both banks of the river there, behind my cave? Rid of snakes, that death-mad swarm, the lazy frogs croak. Today isn't the time to stray from mountain streams. Ajikarani is safe, pleasant, and delightful. And so just sitting there enjoying it. How good is it here to sit here beside this thing, watching the birds flying to and fro, seeing the trees, and then listening to the frogs. Right? So that last verse was a very difficult one to interpret, but what it seems to mean is that for some of the frogs are there, the snakes have gone, right? That death mad swarm, right? It's a very hard one to figure out what it means, but that's what I think it means. That the snakes are a death mad swarm, and they've gone away, and so the frogs can be lazy and croak, and they're sitting there thinking, oh, we're so happy being here. So even the frogs are happy to sit there and just be content. So how much more would one do so? Okay. So, is that enough? I think it's going to be enough for tonight. What do you reckon? Right. So.
Okay.
There we go.
Gataya sarukarangara mase.
Sadhu, anumodaya.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ
Sutupatipanno
Bhagavato Sangho.